to acknowledge the wonderful instant party brought to us by the good people at Tamworth Distilling and Art in the Age. And as you may have heard already, but just in case you haven't, what we've got here tonight are specially created spirits inspired by Andrea Wolf's books, including a Von Humboldt-inspired beverage. And I'm sure they're all wonderful, so feel free to have whatever you like in responsible moderation. now, to introduce Ms. Wolf herself, a very good friend of the library, Jenny Lawrence.
Volume account of his South American journey, wonders of the world, like Aristotle, like Julius Caesar, who appear from time to time as if to show us the possibilities of the human mind. So one of those wonders of the world, yet when I have been talking about the book I'm writing for the past few years, most people, when I said I'm writing a book about Alexander von Humboldt, the most common reaction I got was really a blank face. Because very few people in the English-speaking world have heard of him. And it probably doesn't help that I say Humboldt instead of Humboldt, which is an American way of pronouncing it. But see, I'm German, he was German, and I'm kind of refusing to pronounce his name wrongly, especially because he's so forgotten here. So his name is Alexander von Humboldt. However, if I say Humboldt, I have a little bit of a chance that some people might recognize his name, because his name lingers everywhere. In fact, there are more places, flowers, and animals named after Humboldt than anyone else. There is, for example, the Humboldt Current, which is the ocean current that hugs the west coast of South America. There's the Humboldt Penguin, there's the Caligula Humboldt Lily, there's the Humboldt Squid, the 5-foot squid which swims in the Humboldt Current. There are, in Latin America, there are dozens of parks and mountains named after him. There is the Humboldt Glacier in Greenland. There are mountain ranges in China, New Zealand, South Africa named after him. In North America alone, there are 4 counties and 13 towns carrying his name. Even the state of Nevada was almost called Humboldt when the name was discussed in the 1860s. So who was this man? Let's start with a few facts. Humboldt was born in 1769, same year as Napoleon. He was the second son of a wealthy Prussian aristocratic family. And when his parents died, he became a very wealthy man. And he said, he was so rich, I have so much money that I can get my nose, mouth, and ears gilded. So he was a bit of a show-off. But he left his life of privilege, and he spent his entire fortune on a 5-year exploration of Latin America. It was a voyage that changed his life, or shaped his life, changed his thinking, and that made him legendary across the world. He was a visionary thinker and scientist. His contemporaries said that he was the most famous man after Napoleon. They called him the Shakespeare of the sciences, and he wrote books, dozens of books. Many of those became international bestsellers. He believed that knowledge had to be accessible and popular. He influenced scientists, thinkers, poets, artists. Thomas Jefferson, for example, called him one of the greatest ornaments of the age. Napoleon was jealous of him. Charles Darwin said that he would have never boarded the Beagle without Humboldt, and therefore not written the Origin of Species. Henry David Thoreau's Walden would have been a very different book without Humboldt. John Muir's ideas on forest preservation were influenced by him. Simon Bolivar called him the discoverer of the New World. Even Captain Nemo, and Jules Verne's famous 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, owned all of Humboldt's books. He was, as one contemporary said, the greatest man since the deluge. He was. He died in 1859, just a few months before his 19th birthday. And 10 years later, the centennial of his birth was celebrated across the world in September 1869. There were parties in Melbourne, Mexico, in Moscow, in Buenos Aires, in Egypt, in Germany. But some of the greatest celebrations were actually in America. There were 25,000 people that marched through Manhattan up to Central Park. It took place at Boston in Central Park, and they're still there today, if you want to make a little pilgrimage. There were 3-day parties in San Francisco, there were parties in Boston, Charleston, across America. So the whole world was in love with Humboldt, but the whole of America was completely in love with Humboldt. Yet today, he's almost forgotten here. So why should we care? Why should we care about someone who's been dead for a long time and who's been forgotten? Clearly, I think we should care came up with that idea that nature is a web of life. He described Earth as a living organism where everything was connected, from the tiniest insect to the tallest tree. He brought together the arts and the sciences, and he said that we needed to use our imagination, our emotions to understand nature. He is the forgotten father of environmentalism because he warned of the devastating effects caused by monoculture, irrigation, and deforestation. And amazingly, he predicted harmful human-induced climate change already in 1800. So he was a genius polymath who roamed across the disciplines. He, for example, discovered the magnetic equator in South America. He invented isotherms, the wavy lines which we still see today on weather maps. He defined global climate and vegetation zones at a time when other scientists were still very much looking through the narrow lens of classification. He was a pioneering map maker and really at the forefront of really the founder of what we call today infographics. And he used very complex scientific data in a very visual way. This is, for example, a map of cloud distribution. You can see that he's using color coding and icons. So this is really the very first time that someone is doing this. More than a century before scientists were talking about shifting tectonic plates, he was talking about the ancient connection between Africa and South America. But what is much more important than just these individual discoveries is that he came up with a worldview, a holistic worldview that still very much colors our understanding of nature today. So for me, the invention of nature is really my attempt to find Humboldt and to restore him to his rightful place in the pantheon of nature and the sciences. And the great thing about writing a book about an explorer is that you get to travel to pretty amazing places yourself, all in the name of research. So for me, writing this book was very much a journey through letters, but also through landscapes. And because he's a show-off, I'm a show-off a little bit now. So I went to Berlin, spent a lot of time in the archives there. You can see some of his notes here. I don't know if you can see it from the back, but he has the worst handwriting. this book. I found his passport in an archive in Quito. So this is the passport that the Spanish king had given him, which he used to travel through the Spanish colonies. I read Darwin's annotations in his copies of Humboldt's books, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later. So these two books actually traveled with Darwin on the Beagle across the world. I went up the Antisana and found at 13,000 feet this hut in which Humboldt had spent a night before he climbed the Antisana. And at that very moment, a herd of wild horses appeared, and four condors were circling above me. So that was a pretty good day on research. I paddled along the Orinoco in Venezuela. I saw anacondas, capybaras, the Orinoco crocodile, but I also walked around Golden Pond with freshly fallen snow, and I went to the Yosemite Valley where John Muir had implemented so many of Humboldt's ideas on forest preservation. But the most exciting moment for me was when I climbed Chimborazo, the volcano in Ecuador, which had been so instrumental, so elemental for Humboldt's vision of nature. And as I walked up the barren mountain slope, my admiration for him grew with every single step. It's pretty hard work, and I didn't have to carry any instruments. I had pretty good walking boots. So I only made it to 16,400 feet, but he went even further. So let me take you up to Chimborazo. It's the 23rd of June, 1802. Chimborazo is about 100 miles south of Quito. In 1802, it was believed to be the highest mountain in the world. And Humboldt and his three traveling companions are crawling on hands and knees along a very narrow ridge. And to the left, there's a steep, ice-encrusted cliff, and to the right, doesn't look much better, there's a sheer 1,000-foot drop. he measures. He measures gravity, he measures altitude, he measures temperature, he measures the blueness of the sky, and he knows everything in particulars. And they kind of fall on, and suddenly the fog lifts, and they can see the snow-capped peak of Chimborazo against the blue sky, but they can also see the huge crevasse right in front of them. And he realizes that they can't go any further, they can't cross the crevasse. They are at 19,413 feet, which is about 1,000 feet below the peak. And though they can't go any further, they've achieved something really remarkable. No one had ever been that high. And they hold the world record for several decades. And as Humboldt is standing on the top of the world, seeing the mountain ranges below him, his vision of nature, his ideas of nature clarify, and everything falls into place. And he realizes that the journey from Quito up Chimborazo is like a botanical journey from the equator to the poles, from the tropical species he had seen in the valley, such as banana trees and palm trees, all the way up to the last bit of lichen near the snow line. It was almost as if these vegetation zones were kind of stacked on top of each other. He also realized that many of the plants he had seen walking up Chimborazo, he had seen elsewhere before. He had seen them in the Alps in Switzerland, he'd seen them in the Pyrenees in Spain, and on Tenerife. And he was struck, he said, by this resemblance which we trace in climates most distant from each other. No one had ever looked like this at plants. Where other scientists were looking for taxonomic units for classification, Humboldt realized that nature was a global force. And his brother, Wilhelm, said that Alexander's mind was made to connect ideas, to detect chains of things. And that's exactly what he did. And he did this, he showed this through a drawing. This is a so-called Naturgemälde, which is a pretty untranslatable German term. It means a painting of nature, but with so many German compound matter, has an underlying philosophical meaning that implies a sense of unity. And what you can see here is a cross-section of the Chimborazo. All these little black lines are the plants he had found according to the exact altitude. And then to the left and right, you have 20 columns which give information such as the chemical components of the earth, such of the air, such as gravity, altitude, what animals are, what animals he had found, and other mountains across the world. So you can just trace these lines, and it's all there in one glance. Very, very difficult, complex scientific data. He also calls it my microcosm on one page. But let me tell you a little bit about his exploration. So he and the French botanist, who you can see here on the right-hand side, Aimé Bonpland, left Europe in June 1799, and they spent 5 years in South America, Latin America. And I'm going to have to skip over some really exciting bits because we don't have enough time, so you'll have to read the book for that. But I wanted to give you a flavor of what kind of man he was. He was incredibly restless. He himself said that he felt as if he was chased by 10,000 pigs. And he remained like this until he died. He is obsessed with measurements. He schleps 42 scientific instruments across Latin America, all individually packed in velvet-lined boxes. But he's interested in more than just empirical data. He also says, at a time when other scientists are searching for universal laws, Humboldt says that nature must be experienced through feeling and imagination. So he's really driven by a sense of wonder. He is not a cerebral scholar. He's brazenly adventurous. Take his journey along the Orinoco and the surrounding river networks. He and Bonpland paddled 1,400 miles along the river, 75 grueling days deep in the rainforest, where very few white men had ever gone. And it made for very dangerous traveling. But they also encountered the most magnificent ecosystem on our planet, the tasted, for example, the water of the different rivers, like a wine connoisseur. But he also, they both capsized. They almost starved to death. They encountered dangerous animals, such as crocodiles, jaguars, snakes. But he was fascinated by everything. So he was interested in animals, such as the howler monkey, and listened to their strange bellowing cries, which traveled for several miles through the jungle. He discovered the Brazil nut and subsequently introduced it to Europe. But he was not only interested in nature, he was also fascinated by the indigenous people. And unlike other Europeans, he did not regard them as savages. In fact, he thought he could learn a lot from them, and they were his guides, and he called them the best geographers he'd ever met, the best observers of nature. And he often included them in his landscape and paintings. So this is from one of his books, beautiful books like this big. It's another detail. Humboldt is, of course, the one with the very muscular legs and top hat. But he also returned to Europe with sketches of Inca monuments and Aztec manuscripts. And he showed the Europeans that these ancient civilizations were sophisticated cultures with rich architecture and rich languages. He was not just a scientist. As I said, he was a polymath. He also really created a new literary genre whereby he combined poetic landscape descriptions with scientific observations. And it very much became a blueprint of our nature writing today. And the first book he did this with is a book called Aspects of Nature. Sometimes it's translated as Views of Nature. It was originally published in German in 1807, and it was a book that was so different to any other books because he described nature there more like a poet and not like a scientist. And I wanted to read you a few quotes from there so you can get an idea how he writes. So for example, he described rainbows at the Orinoco as colored bows that shine, vanish, and reappear. He coined a beautiful term for atmosphere. He called it Luftmeer, which means air ocean. Mm-hmm. He talked about leaves that unfolded to greet the rising sun like the morning song of birds. He talked about, he said, what speaks to the soul escapes our measurements. And I found a lovely letter where a friend of his describes a trip they did to the River Rhine in this fall of Latin America in 1790. And this friend describes how he and Humboldt had talked to the animals and plants. And this is what he wrote. We often talk to the plants and rocks along the river because their language was richer and more instructive than the thick books that had been written about them. So this is very, very new at that time. But he also saw, as he traveled through Latin America, he also saw how humankind destroyed nature. And he first really recognized it in at Lake Valencia, which is in northern Venezuela. And what he saw here was how trees had been felled to make way for cash crops, how then heavy rains had washed off the good topsoil, how the water levels of the river were falling because the farmers had diverted the water to irrigate their fields. And seeing this destruction, he was the very first to describe the fundamental functions of the forest to the ecosystem without ever using the word ecosystem. He talked about the tree's ability to enrich the atmosphere with moisture, their ability to store water, their protection against soil erosion, and the forest's ability to, or their cooling effect. It was here at Lake Valencia that he first talked about harmful human-induced climate change. He talked about mankind's mischief, which disturbs nature's order. At the Venezuelan coast, he noted, for example, how unchecked oyster fishing had completely depleted oyster stocks. At the high plateau of Mexico City, He saw how the local irrigation system had left the valleys below barren. He noted how Mayans had exploited the indigenous people and the land. And he said that all problems in the colonies were the result of imprudent activities of the Europeans. A few years later, he described the three ways in which humankind was affecting nature and the climate. He wrote, they do this through the destruction of forests, through the distribution of water, i.e. irrigation, and through the production of great masses of steam and gas at the industrial centers. He wrote that in 1832. So Humboldt and Bonpland traveled through Venezuela, and then they went up to Cuba, and then they returned to South America to the northern coast of what's today Colombia, and then they went all the way down south to Lima and to Peru. 2,500 miles, most of it through the Andes. They climbed every reachable volcano on their way. So by the time they reached Chimborazo in June 1802, they were the most experienced mountaineers in the world. And Humboldt seemed to have enjoyed himself the more difficult it was, the more he seemed to have enjoyed himself. And I found this great letter which he writes to a friend in Germany from Latin America, where he has a long letter that describes in great detail all the dangers he's encountered, including boat capsized and jaguars and crocodiles. And then he ends this letter, this is the last sentence he says, "And you, dearest, how's your monotonous life?" So he was a show off. In 1804, after they've also spent a year in Mexico, they leave Latin America and they want to return to Europe. But Humboldt, in the last minute, adds a little detour because he wants to meet Thomas Jefferson in Washington, who's then the third president of the United States. So he writes to Jefferson, and Jefferson immediately invites him, as you do, and he. Humboldt arrives in early June 1804 in Washington, D.C. And everyone is super excited to meet this explorer. And he gets passed from one person to another. And the timing of Humboldt's visit is absolutely perfect because Jefferson has just acquired the Louisiana Territory in the previous year. And since this explorer has just spent a year in Mexico, the new neighbor of the United States. And Humboldt has also spent a lot of time in the archives. So Jefferson basically bombards him with questions about Mexico, and Humboldt very happily obliges. He unpacks his maps and his notebooks, and he briefs the President of the United States, including 18 very tightly written pages summarizing information about Mexico, about commerce, about agriculture, about mining. So unsurprisingly, Jefferson said that Humboldt was one of the great worthies of the world. And Humboldt absolutely loved America, and he, for the rest of his life, said, "I am half an American." So they returned, after that, they returned to Europe. They arrived there in August 1804 and are celebrated like heroes, and Humboldt settles in Paris, because there's no other European city that's so deeply steeped in the sciences. Very quickly sets himself up as the center of scientific inquiry. He gives lectures, he writes books, he experiments, he jumps so quickly from one subject to another that very few people can actually follow him in his thought. And I just wanted to show you a couple of manuscripts that for me were a real revelation when I saw them. Kind of suddenly everything he did made sense because I thought I could really understand his mind work. So these are his lecture notes. This is how he starts. This is fairly simple. So he starts in a relatively conventional manner, kind of linear, and then he has a few ideas, and you know, he kind of squeezes them in the corner, and then a bit more here, and then he runs out of space. And then he starts writing with some little kind of paper, and he reads something in a book, and he tears out a page, and he reads something in a newspaper, and he tears size of the article, and then he sticks it all on top of each other. And you see these little red dots there, so he invents these kind of, they're like blue tech, basically, from the 19th century, so they're little sticky pads, so you can stick everything on top of each other. So by the end, you have this kind of multi-layered collage of thoughts with no apparent order other than to Humboldt. And I think it really shows that he does not just see nature as a web of life, his mind also works like a web. So he's a busy man in Paris. He has a scientific work during the day. In the evening, he runs from one salon to another, often 4 or 5 in the evening. And we have lots of descriptions of him from that time. People saying that he talks endlessly, he switches from one language to another, and one describes him as an overcharged instrument which never stopped playing. Someone else says he's like a comet that swished through the room. He also had the reputation of having a little bit of a malicious tongue. So there are people who refuse to leave a party before he has come to the party because they're worried that he might talk badly about them. And the only way he can sustain this work pace is by sleeping very little and by drinking lots and lots of coffee, which he calls concentrated sunshine. But after a while, he has quite big financial problems because the exploration, but also the publication of his books kind of eaten up his fortune. And then in 1827, after more than 20 years in Paris, he decides to move to Berlin, a city he absolutely hates. But the Prussian king, who's paid him an annual stipend for the past 2 decades, really had enough that the most famous Prussian scientist is living in Paris. Because France and Prussia were not really that good terms at that time. So he basically demands his return to Berlin. Humboldt, who's run out of money, is not much of a choice, and he moves back to Berlin. But he still manages to have some fun. He goes on yet another exploration, this time to Russia in 1829. He travels 10,000 miles, including racing through anthrax-infested Siberia. He uses 12,244 horses, because he changes horses every 20 miles. So he travels 10,000 miles in less than 6 months, and he's 6 years old. So he's not calming down whatsoever. When he returned to Berlin, he is fizzing with so many ideas that a friend says that Humboldt was steaming like a pot of boiling water. And he is finally ready to write the book that would make him famous in America. He begins his book, Cosmos, which was the first volume was published in 1845. It took him more than 10 years to just write one volume. Eventually you have 5 volumes, it becomes an international bestseller, and it's an incredible book. He takes his readers on this journey from Earth to outer space, from the tiniest speck of moss to the highest peaks of volcanoes, from botany to poetry and landscape painting. So at a time when other scientists are crawling in their ever-narrowing disciplines, Humboldt writes a book that does exactly the opposite. He writes a book that brings everything together. And it's a portrait of nature that's pulsating with life. And he describes nature in this book as a wonderful web of organic life. It's really his declaration of love. And it's the book that makes him famous here in America. Walt Whitman, for example, wrote his poetry collection, Leaf of Grass, with a copy of Cosmos on his table. Edgar Allan Poe admired it, Emerson, Thoreau. So this is really the book that makes him a household name here. And the Invention of Nature is not just a book about Humboldt, because I think what's so important about him is how many people he influenced. So I have also written about the key people he inspired. 8 of them get a chapter. We don't have time to talk about them, but I just wanted to show you who they are. So there's the German poet Goethe, who said that spending a few days with Humboldt was like having lived several years. There's Thomas Jefferson, who remains a lifelong friend of Humboldt's, that corresponded until Jefferson dies. Simon Bolivar, who said that Humboldt's writing and invigorated his revolutions in South America. He actually said that Humboldt had awakened South America with his pen. Henry David Thoreau, who rewrote Walden completely after reading Cosmos. Ernst Haeckel, who was a German scientist, who really more than anyone else, any other scientist, kind of brought together the arts and the sciences, and who also coined the term ecology. John Muir, who was very much influenced by Humboldt's ideas on the functions, the elemental functions of the forest. George Perkins Marsh, another American, again one of those forgotten figures in environmentalism. He wrote a book in 1864 that was called Man and Nature, and that was really, I think it's one of the most important environmental books written in this country. And then last but not least, Charles Darwin, and I want to talk a little bit more about Darwin today. So Darwin, as a young man, read Humboldt's book, Personal Narrative, which you can see here on the right-hand side. Now, this book was a partly a travel account and partly a scientific treatise of Humboldt's expedition in Latin America. And it's a book that changes everything for Darwin. But let's hear it from Darwin himself. He said, my admiration of his famous personal narrative, which I almost know by heart, determined me to travel to distant countries led me to volunteer as naturalist in Her Majesty's ship, the Beagle. On the Beagle, Darwin kept his copies of Humboldt's books on a shelf next to his hand. And amazingly, these books still exist today. And they make for remarkable reading, because when you open them, you can see that there are hundreds and hundreds of annotations and pencil marks. And reading them is like listening to Darwin having a chat with Humboldt. Because Humboldt influenced him in so many different ways. But first of all, Humboldt actually made Darwin go to South America. Once Darwin is in South America, he sees this new world very much through the lens of Humboldt's writing. So this is what he writes when he first arrives in Brazil. This is Darwin. Now, I'm a present fit only to meet Humboldt. He, like another sun, illuminates everything. He also uses Humboldt's books as a model for his own writing. So if you read The Voyage of the Beagle, it's very similar in style to Personal Narrative, this combination of poetic landscape descriptions with scientific information. He also uses Humboldt's books to find examples while he's working on his theory of evolution. And a friend later described Humboldt as a pre-Darwinian Darwinist. So in Humboldt's books, Darwin reads, for example, about the gradual transformation of species. He also reads this. So Humboldt wrote that plants and animals limit each other's numbers. He noted their long-continued contest for space and nourishment. And this is what Darwin writes, for example, in one of Humboldt's books. This is a Personal Narrative, Volume 5. I'm going to read this to you. And so this is what he writes here. He says, to show how animals prey on each other, what a positive check. So here you have it, in a nutshell, the concept of natural selection written by Darwin into Humboldt's book. I'll show you one other Darwin manuscript. So this is a list we historians love people write. This is a list he wrote in 1838, books to be read. Now, I know you can probably imagine how excited I was when I, you know, saw this. And the very first book he wants to read in 1838 is Humboldt's essay, a political essay on the Kingdom of New Spain. So that's like his top at this, on the top of his reading list. But let's have a very quick look at Henry David Thoreau. So Thoreau spent 2 years at Walden. He leaves his cabin in 1847, and he then turns his 2 years there into one of the most famous pieces of American nature writing, Walden, which he publishes in 1854. But he struggles to write the manuscript. He drafts it, and he redrafts it, and he rewrites, and he finally puts it away, gives up on it. And then he reads Homer's Cosmos. And he takes out his manuscript and he completely rewrites it. And that's the world that we know today. In Homer's books, Thoreau really found an answer to how to be a poet and a scientist. It was really the answer to his dilemma. In Cosmos, for example, Humboldt had written descriptions of nature made scientifically correct without being deprived of the vivifying breath of imagination. So Humboldt really allowed Thoreau to kind of weave these two sides together. And Walden really becomes Thoreau's mini cosmos. It's a description of nature in great detail, but also with kind of glorious kind of passion and romanticism in there. It's nature that's really thumping with life. That's Humboldt's nature as a living organism. Let's finish off with John Muir. So John Muir, the father of the national parks, he also read Humboldt's books as a young man. And he said, as a young man, he said, how intensely I desire to be a Humboldt. he also had his books in his library, and these books are also still around. They're in the library in Stockton, California. And like Darwin, he wrote quite intensely into these books. Here you can see he's kind of writing his own index, for example. And they make for remarkable reading because Humboldt is so elemental for Muir's ecological thinking. And I just wanted to show you a couple of pages, and I've kind of highlighted two bits where he has a pencil marker. I'm going to read them to you because you won't be able to read it. So on the left-hand side, Muir marks this sentence: the early colonists imprudently destroyed the forest. You know, that's what he does. That, on the other side, the great forest preserved by their shade a certain quantity of moisture in the soil by sheltering it from the devouring heat of the sun. So he's learning everything he can. He's underlining everything to do with the forest in Humboldt's books. He's also inspired by Humboldt's idea of nature as an interconnected whole, as you know, where everything belongs together, this web of life. And many of you will probably know Muir's very famous sentence, which is, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. That's pure. That's what we get from Humboldt. Like Humboldt, Muir is also driven by this sense of wonder. And it's an approach to nature that really launches into, it's almost like a sensual relationship and it jumps off almost every single page he writes. Nature talks to him. So there are wonderful examples where he, for example, describes gurgling streams as wonderful singers, or animals and mountains were shouting to him, come, come. So nature's really talking to Muir. So again, this is nature as a living organism. And he has this kind of awe for nature. And one of my favorite Muir stories, sadly, has nothing to do with Humboldt, but I think it kind of shows that they thought in the same way. So he goes, he climbs a mountain with Charles Sargent, who's then the director of the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard University. And Muir is just absolutely excited by the colors there. It's full, there's everything's red, and literally jumping up and down, so excited. While Sargent, as Muir described it, was standing there cool as a rock. Then Muir asks him, why he's standing there like this, and Sargent replies this: I don't wear my heart upon my sleeve. This is Muir's reply. Who cares where you wear your little heart, man? There you stand, in the face of all heaven come down to earth, like a critic of the universe, as if to say, come nature, bring on the best you have. I am from Boston. And uniting scientists, in fostering communication across the different disciplines, is still an incredibly important pillar of science today. Today, as scientists are trying to understand and predict the consequences of global climate change, his interdisciplinary methods, his vision of nature as a global force remains incredibly important. Today, we tend to draw a sharp line between the arts and the science, between the subjective and the objective. So I think his insight that we need to use also our imagination to understand nature is important. Call me naive, but when I look, for example, at the Paris climate change in December, what I'm really missing there is this awe for nature, this recognition that we are only going to protect what we love. You had diplomats, civil servants, linguists thrashing out an agreement that was really mainly based on dry statistical projections and very careful legal language, because they had to keep almost 200 countries on board. But what I was missing is this passionate advocacy for our planet. And I think there's a reason why this very iconic photograph of Earthrise, which was taken during the Apollo 8 mission in 1968, has been hailed as the beginning of the environmental movement. Because this is the very first time that we see our Earth in her wholeness. This small white and blue marble set against the vastness and the blackness of space. Unimaginably beautiful, but also so fragile. And that was really a realization that was carried by this sense of wonder. And I think it's the same sense of wonder that drove Humboldt. It's something that I'm missing in present political environmental debates. So Humboldt wrote more than 150 years ago, he warned that the restless activity of large communities of man gradually despoil the face of the earth. So to me, it feels as if we've come full circle. Maybe now is the time for us and for the environmental movement to claim him as our hero. Thank you.
Alexander was the young.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. James Lovelock is, you know, I wrote to him because I wanted to know it. I mean, I'm 100% sure that he has read Homeworld, but he has not kind of written about it. But it's very, I mean, when you read Homeworld's ideas of this, you know, Earth as a living organism, there's some life that's, you know, goes from one pole to the other. It's very much kind of within the Gaia theory. Yes?
Scholarly talk in 10 years. So with the end of this picture, Trish and I were friends of one of the astronauts who walked on the moon and founded an organization based on the impact of that picture. We knew all these people at the beginning of the environmental movement in America. Why was Humboldt forgotten?
I always hope that this question comes. Why was Humboldt forgotten? I think, so there, let me start with first saying that he is forgotten in the English-speaking world. So in Latin America, every school child has heard Humboldt. He's as famous there as Jefferson is famous. But they know him more as a revolutionary, as the friend of Bolivar, so they don't really see him so much as a scientist. I think there's several reasons why he's forgotten, even if he's not completely forgotten in Latin America, but why his work is kind of partly forgotten, is that he, there's not a single individual discovery or theory linked to his name. So he didn't come up with the theory of evolution, for example. So he's not like Darwin or Newton. He comes up with a worldview. His ideas have become so self-evident that the man behind them has almost disappeared, and that's one reason. Another reason is that, so he dies in 1859. He's really the last of the great polymaths. It's the last time that one person can hold so much knowledge in his head. I mean, he's struggling towards the end of his life because the discoveries, the development is just so fast. After that, the scientists specialize so much that scientists become experts, and they begin to look down on people like Humboldt. So they regard him as a dilettante, an amateur. And then, and I think that might also be a reason, he's famous in America, England, until World War I. And then you have, you know, very strong anti-German sentiments. You have the royal family changes their surname to Windsor. You have public libraries in America. For example, in Cincinnati, they burn German books, so that's not really a time anymore to celebrate a German scientist. So I think it's a kind of combination of those kind of things. But I also feel that the kind of we've entered a different time now. So his interdisciplinary methods are, you know, he suddenly seems like a very, very modern science in our age. Yes?
When we were in Berlin, we passed Humboldt University. Is that connected with Humboldt in any way more than the name?
Yes. So it is actually named after Alexander and Wilhelm von Humboldt, but Wilhelm von Humboldt, his older brother, was actually the founder of the university in Berlin. Wilhelm von Humboldt was the Prussian education minister. Was very much, and in front of it are two huge sculptures, one of Wilhelm and one of Alexander. You had a question.
Goethe say anything about
him? Goethe?
Yes.
Yes, yes. They were close friends. They influenced each other really quite immensely. So Humboldt meets Goethe when he's in his mid-20s in 1794. And Goethe, not a lot of people kind of are aware of that, Goethe is not only Germany's most celebrated poet, but he was also a scientist. So these two started by doing science together, they experimented together, and they talked a lot. And so Humboldt is the one who invigorates Goethe's science, but Goethe is really the one who teaches Humboldt to use their imagination is also part of science. So when Humboldt leaves to go to Latin America, he says, I'm leaving with new organs that Goethe has given me. So it's really that through these new, so he begins as this, very much as this Enlightenment scientist, and then he meets Goethe, and then he becomes, he provided that. So he inherited money from, so his father died when he was quite young, and then his mother dies in 96, and they have a very bad relationship. Neither Wilhelm nor Alexander go to her funeral. There's a letter, actually, that a friend writes to Alexander saying, you must be so delighted that your mother is dead. Because finally, as his fortune, she wanted him to be a civil servant in the Prussian government, so he can finally go. So he spends his entire, I mean, he dies a poor man, he spends his entire fortune on this exploration. But that's why he can go to so many places, because he's not bound to a government expedition. One more?
No. His family, he never met, was able to get married because of all his busyness?
I'm pretty sure that he was gay. So he never married, he never had children, no one ever claimed to be his child, no one ever claimed to have had an affair with him and a woman. We don't know 100%, but he has these very intense relationships with younger male scientists. His brother is not too pleased about that, so when Eva Humboldt turns up with one of his friends to stay with his brother, he's not allowed to sleep in the house. They stay in an inn or in a tavern. There are people who, you know, fellow scientists who talk about, oh, so and so is Humboldt's new Adonis. So we're pretty sure, but we will never know 100%. But he did not marry, and he definitely didn't have time to have kids.